Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. In that war, I have had the privilege of knowing people of many stripes and over 40 or so years with a variety of skill sets. Few, I think, are the equal of our first guest. He is, I'm very proud to say, our colleague at the Center for Security Policy, our Senior Vice President for Policy and Programs. But before all of that, a career intelligence professional, a real professional in that very interesting part of the war for the free world, having served for some 20 years in the Central Intelligence Agency as an analyst specializing in some of the non-proliferation threats we're confronting today, as well as the Chief of Staff to then Undersecretary of State, now Ambassador John Bolton, and as a professional staff member of the House Intelligence Committee, he is, of course, Fred Flights, the author of a new book on the North Korean nuclear nightmare and Obama bomb, the great and growing national security fraud. It is a great delight to have him with us. Fred, thank you for joining us.
Hey, Frank, good to be here.
Well, I wanted to start with your professional assessment of another Central Intelligence Agency alumnus, the former director, former chief of station in Saudi Arabia, and other appointments in the director of operations, John Brennan. He is much in the news of late because he has taken to saying that the Russians may have something on Donald Trump as part of a more far-reaching and really increasingly vicious series of attacks on the president. What's John Brennan's background, and where do you think all this is coming from?
Well, Frank, I'm glad we're talking about this. These attacks on the president really have been vicious, and they follow an effort during the presidential campaign by Brennan to try to press other intelligence agencies to conclude that the Russians were trying to help Trump win. Now, whatever evidence he has for that, nobody knows. But he's been campaigning against Trump for a while. But let me first talk about why this is so unprecedented and dangerous. Former CIA directors typically are treated as basically senior statesmen and ambassadors of the agency. They try to promote the agency's expertise and reputation, which is why they try to stay above the fray. For example, I saw Leon Panetta, former CIA director, on Fox yesterday, and he lightly criticized President Trump, but he also said Trump has the right to talk to Putin if he wants to, and he tried to be constructive. But Brennan's searing and visceral and nasty comments against Trump has really fed into Trump's belief that the intelligence community is against him. And let me tell you something else. Former CIA directors retain very high-level clearances. They receive very sensitive briefings from the agency. They frequently meet with senior officials. The belief is because they have such expertise and background, the government should make use of it. So I got to tell you that he's doing so much damage to the agency's reputation, and I believe that because of the irresponsible way he has been treated, he should be stripped of any clearance he has. And if he actually has information that the Russians have been collaborating with Trump, he needs to produce it immediately or shut up.
Yeah. You know, Fred, I part of the backstory here, too, and you've certainly written about this at National Review and elsewhere, is that John Brennan was a political operative for President Obama. Before he became the CIA director, he was in the White House. He worked for him as his Homeland Security advisor. He was appointed by him to be the director of Central Intelligence. And I'd like your, you know, again, professional assessment of his performance, specifically with respect to the politicization of intelligence on his watch at the agency.
Well, John Brennan has been a political animal for a long time, and he worked his way into the Democratic ranks during the Clinton administration by keeping a close relationship with CIA Director George Tenet. Now, he retired briefly and was pushing for Barack Obama to be president before he joined the Obama campaign. So basically, he was not actually director. Obama made him director, but he was actually out of government briefly during the campaign. As a director, he was an utter disaster. The rank and file at the agency couldn't stand him. He was obsessed with political correctness. Remember, Frank, when he once said that the CIA doesn't steal secrets? I had so many friends of mine in the intelligence community saying, like, what is he smoking? Of course it steals secrets. That's its purpose. Brennan also was obsessed with social engineering at the CIA and promoting and hiring people based on criteria to make sure that we hire enough females, enough people of various sexual orientations. So basically we stopped looking for the best and brightest. We were looking for people based on this calculation that Brennan put together because he wanted to have diversity. You know, it doesn't trouble me if PhDs in nuclear physics from Harvard get preference over people from other parts of the country because they're white males, if they're the best. We have to have the best in some of these positions. I'm all for promoting diversity as long as it doesn't undermine national security, but Brennan didn't care about that. He was treating the CIA like it was HUD. We have to have diversity in employment, regardless of capabilities.
Yeah, Fred, you've said something that I really wanted to come back to. This whole idea that the Central Intelligence Agency doesn't steal secrets was, of course, part of a larger effort by the then director, John Brennan, to, as he put it, modernize the whole clandestine services part of the agency. And it had the effect, I'm told, by people who have long experience, including Brad Johnson, chief of station in a number of very difficult places around the world during his career in the director of operations, that it really was all about essentially dismantling America's espionage capabilities. How do you see that? And is that, in fact, a further indictment, really, of Brennan and his time at the agency?
I think Brennan seriously undermined our espionage capabilities. He put together a massive reorganization plan that tried to merge the analysis and collection sides of the business. There's been enormous resistance to this reorganization plan, and people I know at Langley were really hoping it would be reversed. It basically was part of an idea that if we could put collectors and analysts together, we would have better intelligence. I mean, it was misguided from the beginning. It created serious security problems. Frankly, analysts should not be sitting on top of intelligence collectors. It affects the objectivity of the collection. And also there are issues about compromising sources and methods of the identity of sensitive human sources. It was a disaster, and I'm just waiting for it to be reversed.
Yeah, well, it's high time, and here's hoping that will happen in this presidency. We need to take a break here momentarily, but I did just want to ask you one other question on Brennan and his time there. Fred, you wrote extensively and very helpfully, it seems to me, about one of the things that Brennan perpetrated, which was this purported intelligence community assessment that the Russians had penetrated the Democratic National Committee's computers. Would you just say a word about how that was done and why, again, it speaks to the politicization of the intelligence community on his watch?
Well, Frank, there was this bizarre intelligence assessment that came out in early 2017 that found not only that Russia meddled in the election, but did so to help Trump win. And although the left has tried to say this is the unanimous assessment of all intelligence agencies, it actually was the assessment of three intelligence agencies using hand-picked analysts to write this assessment. There were no dissents. There were no alternative views. There was no outside review panel. And Brennan picked at least the CIA participants. And a contact I have on the Hill said Brennan may have helped pick all of the analysts who wrote this assessment. Frankly, this was a rigged assessment to hurt Mr. Trump.
a rigged assessment, false representation about its character, and deep suspicions about the quality of its conclusions. Fred Flights, I understand you might be able to stay with us for another segment. I'd very much appreciate it, as there's so much more to talk with you about. Fred Flights, the Senior Vice President of the Center for Security Policy, will be right back with us for more after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We have one of our top duty experts on intelligence in the House virtually. He is Fred Flights, our Senior Vice President at the Center for Security Policy for Policy and Programs. Also, one of the country's real foremost experts on so many of these topics that touch on intelligence and policy, especially with respect to Iran and North Korea. We're going to talk about all of that with him in this second block. Let me ask you, Fred, first, though, about the spectacle yesterday of some very sensitive materials that were supposed to have been briefed to the president about a conversation he had by phone with the president of Russia, Vladimir Putin, suddenly being all over the front page, I believe it was, of the Washington Post, to feed into this idea that the president isn't taking a robust enough line on Russia. Tell us what's going on there, Fred, and not least how that kind of information could possibly have gotten into the public domain.
Well, President Trump had a phone call with President Putin and congratulated him on being reelected. Now, it turned out that Mr. Trump was given notes for this call that said, do not congratulate Putin. Now, those notes, that advice, was leaked to the press. Now, this is pretty sensitive, Frank. These are confidential insider notes for a president that should never be revealed. So somebody revealed them. Now, they were written, I understand, either by H.R. McMaster or by people in his office. And I am told by a reliable source that the president is very angry that the advice from his advisors has once again been leaked to the news media to hurt him politically. This really is outrageous that this could happen. There's only a small number of people who knew about these notes. McMaster is one of them. His staff, which I might add, he brought in, I believe they're Obama holdovers. They also are aware of it, and frankly, heads have to roll over this.
Amen. It's high time, needless to say. And I'm told that it's not even clear that those notes actually reached the president before he made the phone call, that he was briefed but not shown these particular briefing cards. A scandal on several different levels, but one that it certainly seems to me is just further evidence of the need to clean house at the National Security Council. Fred, you are, of course, the author of a very important new book on the North Korean nuclear nightmare and why Trump must proceed very differently from Barack Obama, who followed this so-called practice of strategic patience with respect to the North Korean threat. Tell us a little bit about the latest on this. Is there going to be a summit? If there is, what do we know about who will participate? And what do you expect might come of it, Fred?
Kim Jong-un made the surprising offer to President Trump to participate in a summit with him, and the president surprised the world by quickly accepting this offer. Now, so far, there's been very little follow-up by North Korea. There was a report this week warning North Korea's enemies not to try to manipulate this conference, but we still don't have a commitment on the date or the place. I understand that's being negotiated by U.S. officials, also by Finnish and Swedish officials. Sweden represents U.S. interests in North Korea. Right now, I suspect the meeting is going to take place, but they have to find a venue. I'd like to see it take place in Seoul. I would like Kim Jong-un to see the prosperity and freedom of South Korea. Might not change his mind. He may come there in a virtual bubble, but I'd rather him see what's going on in the South and how vibrant and developed it is. Now, the latest news is that South Korean President Moon would like to play a role or somehow be involved in these talks between President Trump and Kim Jong-un. I got to say, I have some concern about that because I think Moon is too interested in striking maybe a deal where we give concessions and the North Korea doesn't give up very much. But I think the president is going to hold his ground. I think Mr. Trump could allow Moon to participate. And basically, if North Korea is not going to deal, I think the president will walk away.
You know, it strikes me, Fred, that it might undermine the president on the one hand, because Moon is clearly of an appeasement mindset. On the other hand, it does change the optics of this from one in which the president is elevating Kim Jong-un, one of the worst tyrants on the planet, to the level of a peer. If it's two second-rate powers, or perhaps third-rate for that matter in the case of North Korea, meeting with the president of the United States, sort of a Camp David kind of thing, if you will, when Bill Clinton put together Yasser Arafat and Itzhak Rabin. Let me just ask you, Fred, on one other topic that you've been working on as well for a long time, the departure of Rex Tillerson and the expected, hopefully imminent departure of H.R. McMaster has certainly changed the complexion of the opposition to the president from within his own immediate subordinates to what he wants to do on Iran, North Korea's strategic partner and enabler. To what extent do you think that there is likely to be an end at long last to this defective deal? You've called it the Obama bomb deal. And if so, how soon do you think?
Well, the president has to make a decision by May whether to extend certain sanction waivers. And if he doesn't extend them, we essentially pull out of the deal. But I'm worried. I mean, I like the way you phrased the question, because I believe that problems we've had are not just because of Tillerson. It's also because of H.R. McMaster, who has been aggressively defending this deal and basically undermining what President Trump wants to do. I think McMaster and Tillerson both have to be out of there to go to good policy. What worries me, Frank, is that careerists and a number of political appointees put in place by Tillerson and McMaster are working very hard right now to undermine any withdrawal decision by the president. For example, a man named Brian Hook, who is basically running the State Department for Tillerson, didn't resign when Tillerson did, and he's in Vienna right now negotiating with the Europeans on the Iran deal, frankly trying to find a way where we sort of stay in the deal, even if the president pulls out. An awful lot has to be done, an awful lot of house cleaning, a lot of policy has to be revisited when the president gets a better national security team.
You know, it is striking, and I think most people around the country would find unbelievable what has happened to this president as a result of some very unfortunate personnel decisions. He truly has been surrounded and I think substantially disabled by both senior level appointments and personnel that they have brought in. This is true, especially at the State Department and at the National Security Council. And it's scarcely any wonder that he's had so little to show in terms of tangible results on the ground. I think to varying degrees, his policies have been sound, and certainly his national security strategy overwhelmingly was a very positive thing, it seems. But Fred Fleitz, you've been in the belly of the beast in terms of the bureaucracy, and you know the validity of the old adage by Ronald Reagan that personnel is policy. Say a quick word about that, if you would.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I would add one other thing, is that there are certain think tanks around town that have tried to redefine how to fix the deal, such as the bureaucracy says, well, let's just change the sunset clause. Let's just make it longer. But they don't address the deal's real flaws. And frankly, they're trying to pull the wool over the eyes of the president by putting forward fake fixes that, frankly, Europe might agree to. So far, Europe hasn't agreed to them. But, you know, as long as Iran can enrich uranium, that is to make fuel for nuclear weapons, while this deal's in effect, the deal's invalid. So as I said, there has to be a house cleaning, and all these fake policies that have been put in place by McMaster and Tillerson and their enablers have to be revisited and, frankly, thrown out.
Amen. Fred Fleitz, thank you for your leadership in all these areas, as well as for your weekly visits with us at Secure Freedom Radio. And needless to say, the great work you do with your books on North Korea's nuclear nightmare and the Obama bomb deal. Keep up the good work, my friend. Come back to us again next week. Next up, we will speak with David Goldman. He is Spengler as well, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we are joined by the great David Goldman, also known as Spengler, for the superb columns and essays that he writes at Asia Times, where he is a columnist and director. He is also an advisor to macro hedge funds and an extraordinary intellect on matters both strategic and economic. We're delighted always to have him with us. Welcome back, David. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you for the kind words, Frank.
Well, deserved as well as kind, I think. Let me ask you, I'd like to spend really our time today talking about China. You follow it closely and are a big picture guy, and I think there's a dearth of insights into the sort of macro activities of China. We find ourselves talking about their trade practices or what they're doing in the South China Sea or other aspects of their military buildup and so on. But let me back the lens up to the 30,000-foot level and just pose a question to you if I can, David. It seems to me when you put it all together and you do look at it in the macro sense, it's hard to describe what China is up to as anything other than basically war with the United States, albeit obviously an undeclared one and primarily taking the form of, elements of what they've called unrestricted warfare rather than the old-fashioned kinetic kind, at least so far. But walk us through that. Is that unfair? Is that perhaps presumptuous in terms of where we'll wind up, but we're not quite there yet? I mean, what are your thoughts?
No, it is a war, but it's a special kind of war. China wants to dominate world's high technology, manufacturing, and trade, which is the real source of power. Ultimately, high-tech weaponry is going to be the determinant in any prospective war, and China wants a dominant position. They don't wish to occupy us or occupy Mexico or take over Berlin. It's much more a long-range, tech-based, remote control kind of war.
So domination is the key word there, I guess. And the idea that China, which after all has a history of this sort of thing, going back centuries, millennia in fact, of being the center of the universe with sort of vassal states all around is the model, perhaps, that the Xi Jinping dictatorship, increasingly now the one-man center of power, has in mind, would you say?
I think that's exactly correct. China wants us to be Brazil, a provider of raw materials, liquefied natural gas, soybeans, other agricultural products. While they dominate high-tech manufacturing, and they're making massive efforts to try to leapfrog us in semiconductors, in telecom equipment, in computation, and so forth. And that's an enormous risk, because if they control the technology and we're just the farmers and oil pumpers, we're going to be poorer and weaker, and we're not going to like it.
In that connection, could you talk about us as perhaps a case study of their ambitions, this recently aborted Broadcom takeover of the American company Qualcomm?
The Trump administration was magnificently right to stop that, because China is trying to position itself to dominate the next generation of telecommunications technology. And this is why they're discussed in the media, that Qualcomm has a key position in the manufacturing of chips for smartphones, and a Singapore-based company controlling Qualcomm would be in position to assist the Chinese in their top objective, which is to control the next generation of wireless telecommunications, so-called fifth generation or 5G. And we don't want that to happen, because if they do that, they'll not only control the manufacturing and the e-commerce and the computation, they'll control also the communications. Will be completely insecure forever.
And in point of fact, what this 5G technology represents, as I understand it, is the effort to actually dominate the Internet of Things, the coming sort of technology for not simply, facilitating interfaces between us and our refrigerators or our self-driving cars, but really all aspects of life. And it seemed that this was part and parcel of, as you say, that kind of visionary long-term ambition to exercise dominion.
Well, 5G increases wireless transmission speeds by 100 times. And that makes possible a whole range of technologies that no one's even thought of yet. It's transformational. It's like the invention of the telegraph or the telephone. It's hugely important. Whoever dominates that is going to have a leg up on every technology that spins off from that. And that's what the Chinese want. Telecommunications, wireless broadband, e-commerce, and e-finance are where the Chinese have an advantage and they're trying to exploit it. And that's where the world is heading. They want to be in control of it.
Yeah. So at this moment, in addition to blocking this Broadcom operation, the president is apparently poised to insert tariffs on Chinese products coming into this country. I assume many of them will be of that high-tech character. The Chinese, of course, are making rather bellicose noises about responding quite aggressively. As an economist by training, David Goldman, what do you anticipate will come of all of this?
Well, tariffs are always painful. As Larry Kudlow wrote just before his appointment as head of the Economic Council at the White House, they're a tax. And we may need them for national security reasons and defensive reasons, but they always cost money. They'll result in lower growth. So we'll be poorer than we otherwise might have been. But my biggest worry, Frank, is that tariffs are playing defense. To a great extent, that's closing the barn door after the horse has been stolen. What I'm much more concerned about is playing offense, that is, using the American capacity to innovate, which is unique in the world, to leapfrog the Chinese and compete with them at the frontier of innovation in a way that they're not really well positioned to do. And that's what we really have not been doing, not since the Reagan administration days of Strategic Defense Initiative and all the massive investment we put into the military buildup that won the Cold War.
Yeah. You know, I'm so interested you refer to that, David, as I was intimately involved with it at the time, that we're going to be marking, I believe it's the 35th anniversary of the president's visionary speech about the need to defend the American people, not simply avenge them, tomorrow, as a matter of fact. But it does seem as though particularly the piece of that vision that the president had, that the Chinese have, it seems, embraced and we have not so much, is the notion of having space-based capabilities to exercise dominion from the high frontier, as it's been called. Your thoughts on what the Chinese are doing in space and its implications?
Well, the Chinese have a massive dual-use investment program. They're also gearing their education system to produce the kind of people who can do things like that. They produce twice as many STEM PhDs as we do now. They have a $40 billion government budget for semiconductor innovation or stealing technology or taking over technology, buying it, whatever. Chinese are focusing their efforts from the top down with massive resources to attain technological superiority. Now, I don't think we should have the same kind of top-down approach that they do. It's not that efficient. But why not have a Manhattan Project for a space-based anti-missile defense? Why not have a Manhattan Project for 5G wireless technology to make sure we dominate it?
Very impressive visionary projects indeed. And it does seem to me, David, that they're the sort of thing that we need, especially if this rivalry is, as I fear, going to, in the end, translate into that other use of this high technology, namely for military purposes, being brought to bear against us.
It always does. The president is absolutely right to address the problem. He's right to stop technology transfers. And in some cases, he may be right on tariffs, but that's playing defense. You don't win wars by defense. You win them by offense. And that's the dimension we haven't seen yet.
But you may need a combination of the two. David Goldman, also known as Spengler, thank you very much for your time today. It's great to talk with you, and I appreciate, as always, particularly that 30,000-foot perspective that you bring to bear so well. Keep up the good work, my friend. Come back to us again very soon. We'll talk to you in the near future. Next up, we will speak with Colonel Sellin about what's happening in South Asia and its implications for all of us, especially vis-a-vis China. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are joined by Dr. Colonel Lawrence Sellin. He is a retired U.S. Army colonel of the reserves. We've spoken with him in the past about a number of aspects of his extraordinary career and their relevance to today, including his service in the South Asian and Central Asian environment, notably Afghanistan, northern Iraq, and he has also performed humanitarian missions in West Africa. He is conversant in Arabic and Kurdish and has a pretty good handle on IT matters as well, a man of many parts. And always a welcome guest here. Colonel, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Oh, thank you, Frank.
I was moved to try to grab you quickly and have been very happy to find we could to talk about a brand new paper that has just been circulated by you through the Hudson Institute South Asia Program. And it talks about a piece of what has been a festering sore for a long time, namely Pakistan, with a particular angle that, frankly, I have not focused on, and I suspect others in our audience have not either, and that is the Iran-Pakistan border and the fact that it is, as you put it, a geopolitical powder keg. Give us a little bit of a sense of what's at work there, and then we'll talk through what some of the geopolitical implications are.
Yes, that's right, Frank. I think the take-home message for Americans is that while we're trying to create stability in Afghanistan, Afghanistan is actually in a sea of regional instability. And the example I give in this particular article is the Iran-Pakistan border, which has multiple elements of instability occurring simultaneously. For example, you have national rivalries, not just between Iran and Pakistan on their joint border, but the Chinese are involved, the Saudis are involved, the Indians are involved. You also have a religious conflicts, the Sunni-Shia divide between Iran being Shia and Pakistan being Sunni. You have an active ethnic separatist movement, insurgents in Balochistan. And you have ongoing espionage on both sides of the border. You have drug smuggling and human trafficking, and many of these components are acting together. So it's an extremely volatile area that eventually, at least parts of it, spill over into Afghanistan.
And, of course, Pakistan has been, a perennial problem with respect to Afghanistan. But do you anticipate, for all the reasons that you've mentioned, that they may come to blows, the Iranians versus the Pakistanis? And talk a little bit about the lengths that the Chinese have gone to try to prevent such a thing from happening.
Well, that's exactly right, Frank. It's not just me. It's the Chinese have been actively involved. And I've been following this for almost a year now, and a lot of it has not been published in the media. But, of course, China has a very large investment in Pakistan, known as the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. And so they have billions of dollars invested in developing projects in Pakistan, including a very important seaport in Gwadar. So Gwadar is actually very close to the Iranian border. So they have actually brokered a number of meetings between security meetings between the Iranians and the Pakistanis to try to get control over the area, because as I mentioned, you have all these different elements of instability acting more or less simultaneously.
Yeah. In the previous segment, we spoke with David Goldman about China's ambitions, which are certainly evident in this part of the world, as they are more broadly in the so-called New Silk Road Initiative. And David made the point that one of the things that is always at work in these Chinese strategic initiatives is military capabilities as well. As I recall, they're very busily building up not just commercial seaport activity in Pakistan, but also a military naval base there as well. Talk about that and how that factors into not just this issue of the Iranian-Pakistani time bomb, perhaps, but also more generally, the projection of power by the Chinese in that part of the world, including the Persian Gulf, perhaps.
Well, that's right, Frank. That's why this border area is so important to the Chinese, because it's not just the commercial enterprise in the seaport of Gwadar, but they have planned a military base, primarily a naval base, on the Jiwani Peninsula. Now, it just so happens that the Jiwani Peninsula sits between Gwadar and the Iranian border, so it's even closer. It's actually well within the area of the border, this planned Chinese naval base. And that naval base is important for China not only to protect its investment in Gwadar, but it's at the mouth of the Persian Gulf, so strategically located such that it will influence the sea lanes in the Arabian Sea, particularly the oil export sea lanes, which they're very dependent on. But it also boxes in a lot of the U.S. bases inside the Persian Gulf and really outflanks the U.S. naval base in Diego Garcia. So it's a very important element, and that's why the Chinese have been so actively involved in the border area, and we're trying to work with the Iranians and Pakistanis to solve some of these instability problems.
So you have been thinking about these issues and writing on them most recently, as I said, at the Hudson Institute, Dr. Sullen. But talk about what American policy should be. The Chinese have been cultivating relations with both the Iranians and the Pakistanis. They are clearly building out infrastructure that has military as well as civilian implications. As you say, they may well be positioning themselves to box in our fleet in the Persian Gulf, or our ability to exercise control over those sea lanes of communications that flow from the Persian Gulf eastward, Diego Garcia and so on. What would you, if you were talking to President Trump, be recommending he do at this moment in time, given all of this?
Well, I think the main point is that we're missing, you know, the forest for the trees. We've been concentrating on nation building and counterinsurgency in Afghanistan. And there are a number of elements, in particular Pakistan, that works against that. Of course, Pakistan supports the Taliban and the Haqqani network. And we have no way of countering that, because they have safe havens inside Pakistan. And also Pakistan controls the supply of our troops to Afghanistan, because Afghanistan is landlocked. So we're, militarily speaking, we're in a very difficult position, even executing our limited mission there. But overall, we're missing the bigger picture, which is China and what China is doing with Pakistan and its overall ambitions, not only in South Asia, but globally, where it's creating this, as you brought up earlier, the Belt and Road Initiative, which is not only economic, but it, associated with that economic effort is a string of military bases, often referred to as a string of pearls.
Fascinating, and so much more to talk with you about than we have time to do properly, Dr. and Colonel Sullen. I do want to just say, as I was saying to David Goldman a moment ago, we're missing this big picture on China, and it's so vital that it be applied here, because we're not going to make the right tactical decisions, including potentially on opportunities to supplant China with many of these governments that they're cultivating. or trying to dominate at least. But we have to be focused on doing that. And we look forward to visiting with you in the near future about other steps that we might take to protect our interests in this complicated and very dynamic region. Thank you for your time today and for this important new paper at the Hudson Institute. I commend it to all of our listeners. Come back to us again very soon.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we are joined by Jose Cardenas, long a very senior and influential figure in U.S. government circles with respect to Latin America, having held key posts in the U.S. Department of State, the National Security Council, and USAID. And in fact, he served as the acting assistant administrator for Latin America and the Caribbean at AID back in the Bush administration. He is a great expert on these matters, blogs at Foreign Policy Magazine's Shadow Government, and is an associate with Vision America. It's great to have him with us. Jose, welcome back.
Thank you, Frank. Always a pleasure to join you.
Well, we are speaking in what was supposed to be the aftermath of Vice President Pence's address to the Organization of American States here in Washington, but because of the snow day yesterday, the speech didn't happen. He was going to be describing, I think, if I'm not mistaken, Jose, kind of what to expect in President Trump's visit to the region coming up in April. What do you think is likely to be on that agenda, even in the absence of the vice president showcasing it for us?
Yes, Frank. The speech was indeed supposed to be somewhat of a curtain raiser for President Trump's first visit to Latin America for the Summit of the Americas, which is to take place in Peru next month. And the Trump administration, it's somewhat ironic that for all of the campaign rhetoric and the attendant commentary that suggested that President Trump was systematically destroying U.S. relations with Latin America, the Trump administration really is coming at it with a very positive approach to its relationship with Latin America. It sees opportunities there, whether they are economic or political, with like-minded governments in the sense that the Chavista wave of left-wing populism has crashed. And so there are more presidents and leaders in Latin America that want good relationships with the United States, that want trade ties, and that want to do something about the erosion of democracy in Venezuela. So it was going to be an attempt to really find common cause with some of these like-minded leaders.
And it's pretty clear that what is concentrating their minds, you know, the old line about a conservative is a liberal who is mugged by reality. It certainly seems as though, speaking of Chavez and his chosen successor, Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela, have really demonstrated literally the bankruptcy of their ideas and their model. One of the places where the president has been, it seems, exercising some welcome leadership, Jose Cardenas, is with respect to tightening the screws on Nicolas Maduro's regime in Venezuela. Talk a little bit about that and how that is helping to forge perhaps an improved relationship with some of these other Latin American countries that are feeling the effects, particularly of what's happening in Venezuela now.
Let me just start with your last point there, Frank, and that is neighbors of Venezuela that are indeed feeling the effects of the disaster in Venezuela. Its neighbors, Colombia and Brazil, and even islands in the Caribbean, are all experiencing refugee flows from Venezuela into their countries, and it is creating a regional crisis. What the Trump administration is doing towards Venezuela is basically a two-track approach that is working very well. On one hand, it is devising targeted sanctions meant to cripple Maduro's ability to basically stay in power. Rather than carpet bombing Venezuela with broad-based sanctions, these are more surgical. They are targeting individuals, and they are targeting specific escape valves, if you will, for the Maduro government. One is, blocking U.S. sources of finance from helping Maduro resurface his debt. Secondly, targeting the Maduro government's attempts to use cryptocurrency because they are so bankrupt. And then on the other side, they are working with partners in the region to, again, diplomatically isolate the Maduro government and apply sanctions of their own, specifically targeted the regime, not the Venezuelan people.
Yeah. And on this cryptocurrency business, one of the reports that I've seen, Jose Cardenas, is that the Russians have been involved in trying to help, I guess, one of their client states pull off this vehicle for essentially trying to prop up their failed economy with a cryptocurrency they call the Petro. What do you know about that, and how does that factor into the kind of pressure that the president's trying to bring to bear?
It is certainly another indication of the desperation, of the economic desperation of the Maduro government. When you look at their oil sector, it is production is down, and they have systematically destroyed every other sector of the economy. They are bankrupt. They're attempting to sell gold to acquire hard currency. That's how bad it is. This maneuver is simply an attempt to, again, defy economic reality by seeking some sort of salvation in a cryptocurrency. On the Russian side of the ledger, by all means, Putin sees opportunity, not economic opportunity, in Venezuela, although Russian oil companies are scarfing up distressed properties in Venezuela. But for Putin, Venezuela exists simply as an opportunity to mess with the United States by propping up Maduro. He is not going to invest billions of dollars into Venezuela, but Putin is otherwise going to see what he can do on the cheap to continue to destabilize what basically the Russians see as the United States near abroad. They equate their activities in Venezuela with, for example, what Putin sees as the United States mucking around in countries on its perimeter or periphery.
Yeah. Speaking of on the periphery, one of the things that is not getting, it seems to me, the attention that it requires is an upcoming election in neighboring Mexico, one of our most important regional partners, but also our immediate neighbor, of course. And that is the prospect that a fellow by the name of López Obrador might prove to be the next president of Mexico. Very quickly, what is Obrador's record, and what might that portend, not just for NAFTA and other issues of mutual interest, but even for our security?
Frank, it's a critical issue. As you well know, there's no country that more directly impacts U.S. homeland security than does Mexico, of course, because of our 2,000-mile border with Mexico. AMLO, as he's known, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, is cut from the same left-wing populist cloth that Hugo Chavez came from. Well, I know that we basically said that wave has crashed, but there are some outliers still out there. He is taking advantage of a lot of internal dissatisfaction, irregardless of Donald Trump's administration, but of popular dissatisfaction in Mexico with corruption, with lack of jobs. And so he is gaining oxygen. And what it means, Frank, is that if AMLO wins in Mexico, you are almost certainly going to see a distancing of Mexico from security cooperation and political cooperation with the United States.
More on that soon. Jose Cardenas of Vision America, thank you so much for your time today, as well as the great work you do there and your accumulated public service to our country. It's great to talk with you, and I look forward to doing so again soon. I hope to talk to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.